Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Salve.
Ciao.
Buongiorno.
Greetings and welcome to the Italian Studies channel on the New Books Network. We are your hosts. I'm Ellen Nirenberg from Wesleyan University.
And I'm Giancarlo Lombardi from the College of Staten Island and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York.
I'm Nicoletta Marini Maio from Dickinson College.
Whether you're a colleague and expert in the field of Italian studies,
or just curious about Italian history, culture, politics, and language,
we are your podcast destination.
The aim of the Italian Studies channel is to provide a broad spectrum of listeners access to exciting new research within the field of Italian studies.
Italian studies is a fascinating interdisciplinary field. It spans literary studies, cultural studies, cinema and television studies, theater and performance, the history of science, the history of art, and music, among many, many other fields.
That's right, Nico. Our conversations here are with scholars who have produced recent research across many and varied fields and topics.
Ellen, Nicoletta, and I are scholars of modern and contemporary Italian studies, but our mission is to bring you the best of new scholarship in the field, from medieval literature to the most recent cinema and television.
And the focus, approaches, and methods of study will differ. And what we hope emerges from our conversations is an idea of the richness the field has to offer to many and different listeners.
So welcome to the Italian Studies channel on the New Books Network.
Grazie dell'ascolto.
And thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Italian Studies channel of the New Books Network. This is your host, Giancarlo Lombardi. Our guest today is Onya O'Healy, author of Migrant Anxieties, Italian Cinema in a Transnational Frame, which was just published by Indiana University Press. Onya O'Healy is professor of modern languages and literatures at Loyola Marymount University. Her research interests lie in transnational cinema, contemporary Italian film, and migration studies. She has published widely in Italian screen studies and is editor with Aniko Imre and Katarzyna Marciniak of Transnational Feminism in Film and Media. With these two scholars, Onya also edits the Global Cinema series for Palgrave. Welcome to NBN, Onya. It's such a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, Giancarlo. It's a pleasure to talk to you too.
So let's begin. In the introduction of your book, you say that your overarching aim, and I quote here, is to unravel some of the complex issues interwoven in representations of the immigrant or the foreigner in these cinematic texts. Representations that symptomatize the shifting identifications and oppositions that have marked Italian society since the end of the Cold War. The films explored here raise questions related to Italy's historically fragile sense of nationhood, as well as its poorly acknowledged histories of colonial conquest and immigration. Now, I would like to begin by asking you to unpack for our listeners this important point of departure, maybe telling us a little bit about the organization of your book as well.
Yes, well, the organization of my book is not entirely chronological, but it seeks to unpack certain issues that have emerged in films produced in Italy since the beginning of mass migration. First of all, from Eastern Europe, Albanian particularly, in particular, and then later from Africa. So these representations, as I have discovered, refer to or resonate with issues that have long troubled Italian society, such as the North-South divide, the history of emigration from Italy, and of course, colonial memory, which is sporadically acknowledged and often disavowed in terms of what actually transpired during Italy's colonial history in Africa, as well as in other parts of Europe. So I saw in these films a wrestling with the past, a wrestling with unacknowledged issues of Italian history, and an overlaying of some of the unspoken racializations that accompany those memories, and the projection of those onto the figure of the foreigner in Italian film. So that's what I tried to unpack, you know, what's resonating here with the history of Italian emigration. I mean, it's most obvious in the sort of canonical film of Italian cinema about migration, which is the first film by Amelio on this issue, L'America. It's very clear there, and it's deliberate too, references both to Italian colonial history and to Italian emigration. So what I try to show is not only the sort of explicit intentionality of the filmmaker, as happens in this case, but also some of the unintended issues that surface in representation, such as anxiety about Italian whiteness, anxiety about Italian subalternity vis-a-vis the rest of Europe, the unresolved divisions between North and South, and so on.
Well, this is great. This is exactly where I wanted to go next, as a matter of fact. I wanted to work with your title. The very title of your work evokes the concept of anxiety, as you said, and you go at great length to keep this concept alive in the mind of your reader throughout the chapters of your book. How would you define such anxieties? And here the plural is fundamental. And how have they evolved in cinema produced in the last three decades?
Yes. I must say that this title for my book is something that emerged very late in the project, and I was really fascinated when it emerged for me very clearly and all of a sudden that this is what the book is about. And it's true, you've hit the nail on the head. It's anxieties of different kinds generated by different subjects about different acknowledged or unacknowledged issues. And cinema lends itself very well to the expression of anxiety. I mean, it's been there forever in some genres more than others, in horror, in film noir, in suspense mysteries, and so on. But my allusion to anxiety in the book's title has multiple associations, mainly three, actually. The anxieties of Italians vis-a-vis mass immigration in general, and more specifically vis-a-vis the growing presence of people of non-Italian heritage in Italy today. Second, of course, there's the anxiety of the migrants themselves, which are diegetically represented, their worries about survival, about the hostility they encounter, and of course, the lingering trauma of their trajectories, because some, before they get to Italy, have experienced unbelievable horrors in detention and assault and near drowning along the way. And these are conveyed pretty effectively in many films. But then more interestingly for me, there's another kind of anxiety, migrant anxiety, which is the type of anxiety that migrates and circulates between one context and another. How there's a sort of transference, if you like to use a psychoanalytic term, say, of the legacy of colonial era affect, of racism and fears about Italian subalternity. These are unacknowledged, mostly unacknowledged anxieties that affect or attach themselves to to new subjects of representation, but their origins are actually displaced from elsewhere. So you have the historical memory of Italian economic emigration, which economic emigration has become a reality again in the 21st century, as worried young Italians now go abroad again to make a living at the very moment that young foreigners are continuing to pour into Italy to find work. So these anxieties migrate and morph, and they gain traction, and they sort of contaminate the scene of cohabitation, although they are not explicitly spelled out for what they are or what their origins are.
I see. It's actually, this ties into the following question I wanted to ask you, which is a question that is methodological in a way. Still in your introduction, you mention your intention to look out for the ideological blind spots of a given film. This is how you call them. Elsewhere, echoing the fathers and even more so the mothers of deconstruction, you say that you strive to identify tensions and contradictions underpinning representations. I'm thinking here about, you know, the textual areas of discomfort that Barbara Johnson talked about, citing actual dangers of realistic fiction. What is the process? How do you identify, how do you locate in these films the representation of the migrant condition that, as you say, resonates with the reproduction of the white national subject? And here, you know, feel free to draw examples from films and how you went about in your analysis.
Mm-hmm. Well, my methodology always starts with repeated viewing of every film that I might possibly imagine drawing into this conversation. So my methodology is first and foremost a sort of painstaking engagement with the text, because that's the way I was trained in film studies. You know, I sort of cut my teeth in film studies in the late 80s when engagement with the text was primary, and looking for these gaps and elisions of within the text itself was what was encouraged at the time. So, and I also, have followed theorists such as Robert Stamm and Ella Showatt in their examination of Western constructs of the other, and what they identify as the dangers of realistic fiction. Because realism, above all forms of representation, hides its own strategies of enunciation, so it can easily seduce the viewer into imagining that they have untrammeled access to the real. So the danger that lies in this when we're looking at representations of non-Western subjects is that as viewers who have no other access to those realities, it's easy to imagine that this is a mirroring of the actual world, where of course it's not. It's mediated, as all films are. So that's my point of departure. That awareness, accompanied by the close reading process, I pay attention to point of view, subjectivity, and other things that influence the interface between. Between the viewer and the text itself, the constructions of subjectivity, and so on. For example, I'm very attentive to the way non-Italian subjects are always marked as different within a film text, whether by their speech, their film, their skin color, their clothing, their posture, and so on. And I focus on how this difference becomes the principal trait of their characterization, and the ways they're framed, in which they're framed to accentuate this condition. And then I also look at how identification and disidentification works, because sometimes when identification is what the film encourages, in the process it erases all difference, and that too is ideologically it's a questionable move, because it really erases the subjectivity of the other by subsuming the other into the self.
Okay, actually, it's really interesting how we are basically going to every, from one question to the other. You're anticipating some of the questions that I'm about to ask you, as a matter of fact. So affect plays an important role in your close readings of many films. And let me say here, Anya, that it is such a pleasure to read your close readings. Your close readings are engrossing. One feels that you're actually watching the film. And they're extremely useful. And they have a dual use, one for the scholar and one for the student. One can already see how so many parts of your books are so easily used, could be so easily used in the classroom. It's fantastic. Your book is a lesson in style in many ways. But to go back to affect, it is extremely important in your close reading, and it does so at many differing levels. At the same time, great attention, as you said, was devoted to questions of focalization and identification. How do you see these three concepts, affect, focalization, identification, evolving or morphing in the films you analyze, in this corpus that starts from the films about Albania to the films, to the more recent films about African migrants?
Well, yes, affect theory has had a big influence on the way I watch films. So starting with the work of Sara Ahmed and Lauren Berlant, I've started to look at films or try to unpack films, what they say, in aspects that are non-linguistic, and also in examining even the reception of these films, I try to unpack the linguistic or the written accounts of the films in terms of the unsaid, you know, the bodily affective economy that's playing out beneath what is said. And it's become very unpopular to talk about the unconscious, because that harks back to psychoanalysis, which is out of date. And I had a lot more psychoanalysis in my book in the first draft, but I realized nobody takes this theory anymore. So I had to take huge amounts of it out. But the intersection of psychoanalysis and affect theory is implicitly still there. You know, I'm very aware of what Sara Ahmed calls the affective economy, rather than the ideas underlying Italy's reaction to its immigrants. So affect theory takes the emphasis of language, of the rational, and instead it sees power as generating in the senses, in the body, in the more sort of animal side of human experience. Entirely irrational, of course, but one cannot deny its existence and its force in generating responses to things like immigration.
And how about questions of focalization and identification? I mean, in as you talk about focalization in your book, you mention about the fact that a lot of times it's the gaze shifts. In L'America, you have a really captivating analysis about how the gaze shifts from one character to the other, and that carries a lot of consequence. Also, how does that affect identification? And in the final chapter of your book, you actually talk about the you know, identification, disidentification, misidentification. I know you already mentioned this earlier, but I would like for us to hear a little more about it.
Well, the process of identification is actually pretty straightforward. There are characters within a film script that we are prompted to align ourselves with as viewers. This is very clear in L'America, as you said. when you first meet Michele, for example, who's then called Spiro, he's in an Albanian prison camp, and he's filthy and objectified as almost like an object rather than a subject. So the focus, the focalization in that scene would be the visitors from Italy who are looking at this abject creature of powerlessness and ignorance, really. And then he becomes later on the focalizer. So we began to recognize his subjectivity. So focalization is also about subjectivity. We are encouraged to enter into his point of view. And he then becomes sort of redeemed in his humanity and in his distinctive generosity as a human being. So it's very cleverly orchestrated. But what we're really looking at here is the transformation of this character from an abject alien into a sympathetic Southern Italian wise man, who then becomes kind of an exemplar of humane behavior, because he's generous to those who are less fortunate than he is, and he makes these pronouncements that are full of wisdom, even though he's a senile character. So you have this movement of identification or of attachment to these figures as the people within the diegesis with whom we admire, whom the audience admires. So he's kind of set up as an exemplary Italian subject by the end of the film. And in his Italianness, he becomes human and an exemplary subject. So that's how it works there. But in the process, the ideological pitfalls of that is that the Albanians are never given that same possibility within the film. They remain blank screens. They remain unknowable, inarticulate, unreachable. So, at the expense of Michele, when he becomes Italian within the diegesis, when he's recognized, he starts to evolve as a human being. But the others remain what they were, which is blank screens. So that's what I talk about when I talk about the pitfalls, this elevation of the Southern Italian in a story that's set in another country, but it's really about Italy. And it's the erasure of the reality of the other, the diversity of the other, that one sees over and over in Italian film. When you have identification with a character that may seem other at first, what the film is doing is turning them into one of us, so to speak. That's what the...
So the erasure, this erasure is also seen as parallel to the whole idea of passing, that is so central to many of the readings that you do. How do you see that evolving through in the corpus of the films you analyze?
Yes. Well, that's fascinating that you say that, because I hadn't thought of that script or of that way of reading the narratives. Can you tell me what you mean? I'm not entirely sure.
Well, I mean, you're certainly starting, you're starting from the Albanian. If we look at the chapters that you have, the chapter breakdown, the first two chapters are about Albania and then Eastern Europe, and then you move to Africa. And so much of the first two chapters has got to do with bodies that are unmarked at some levels. It's almost the stessa faccia, stessa razza kind of thing going. And then when it comes to Africa, that is no longer a possibility. But at the same point, you bring up in chapter two the question of affect when you're talking about the badante. And at the same time, when you're talking about the Eastern European prostitute, you have the affective disposability of the final migrant. And you make a very important statement about, what happens to prostitution, not just in cinema, but in reality, once migration starts. And where does the eternal image, the classical image of the Italian streetwalker that was so famous, in was made famous by, you know, directors like Fellini, for instance, where does she disappear?
Right, she disappears from Italian screens, and we have instead streetwalkers of first of Eastern European origin, and then a different type of streetwalker from Africa. They're two different categories in these films. They're very, the representation of them is very different. But to get back to what you were mentioning about passing, I think you're referring here to what I call the discourses of whiteness and the ability of white Eastern European migrants to become invisible, their difference to become invisible in Italian public places. So they make a sub, they can become a substitute for the Italian female body in particular sectors of the economy, such as prostitution and home care or elder care. You know, the badante, the Eastern European badante can be absorbed into the family context because she's not visibly marked as different. And that was a practice. It's changing now. There, in real life, there are more and more Filipinas and Sri Lankans who occupy this position. But for a long time, it was Eastern European women were considered ideal for this this position because they kind of passed in a way that Italians found acceptable. But in the films, this passing is always questioned in terms of the visual representation. The non-European white characters are always marked with some visible difference that is not startling, but it's always there, whether it's in clothing or posture or screen time or casting or whatever, it's always there. And it's fascinating to me how these different levels of whiteness are determined. And in this respect, I'm very interested in new work on what Italian whiteness is, particularly Gaia Giuliani, who writes about the construction of Mediterranean whiteness in Italy, which is different from Aryan whiteness. I'm interested in looking at how this plays out in the films, although I don't think I discuss Mediterranean whiteness in any great detail, but it's one of the things that I'm interested in when I look at these representations of Eastern Europe. And I see it in all of the films that are set in the Balkans that were made in the 1990s, and even more recently in a film like Venuto al Mondo by Castellitto, where you have the whole question of genetic identity. You know, how can a child who's actually not Italian at all pass as Italian in contemporary society? That film has been widely criticized and because of its aesthetics, but I find it fascinating in terms of the ways in which it addresses these very issues.
Let's move to questions that are somewhat more philosophical in kind. The work of Jacques Derrida and Emmanuel Levinas is prominent in your study of migrant cinema. How is the ethics of hospitality, so perfectly encapsulated by the work of these two philosophers, portrayed in the Italian films you analyze?
Yes, I do draw on Levinas and Derrida to some extent in discussing the concept of hospitality. But I find that their insights are often undercut in the way that hospitality is actually represented in Italian film. I mean, I was very drawn to Levinas at first because of his idea of, you know, the face of the other. I liked his idea of ethics preceding metaphysics. In other words, that our primal responsibility, or ethics preceding ontology even, and of our primary responsibility to the needs of the other. All of this is very idealistic. But I also like the notion that the other is always separate from the self, always in some way inscrutable. And that separateness is what has to be respected. That otherness itself is what has to be respected. However, in Italian films' configuration of hospitality, what the films do is deny this difference by turning the other into the self-same, you know, in the way that Irigaray critiques the patriarchal configuration of femininity. You know, you say they're just like us, therefore they shouldn't be discriminated against. But what Levinas is actually saying is that their very diversity is what needs to be respected. So I, in the end, even though I read quite a bit of Levinas and Derrida's ideas of hospitality, what I saw was the contradiction of that. Because in the way that difference is subsumed into sympathy and humanitarian rescue in many Italian films actually erases the otherness of the other.
What do you think movies like Mediterranea or Fuoco a Mare have done in this respect? I mean, I would like to really go and talk about, you know, films that our listeners might have actually heard about because they're both being distributed heavily in the United States.
Well, I'm glad to hear that they have been distributed heavily in the United States. I hadn't been aware.
They were available on Netflix, I believe, both of them.
Yes. Oh, I see. Yes, yes. Fuoco a Mare certainly left a trace, and many people I've talked to have actually seen it or part of it. Many people have found it difficult to watch all of it because it is not a cheerful film by any means. But I have mixed, as you probably know from having read my discussion of that film, I have mixed reactions to it because of the preponderance of village life as the main storyline, and which is interesting. I mean, aesthetically, Rosi's project is brilliant. He makes fascinating cinema from the point of view of anthropology and documentary aesthetics. It's really quite beautiful. But in the depiction of the migrants, there are so many contradictions that it leaves me feeling very uncomfortable. Hospitality, I would see reflected in the humanitarian mission of the doctor, the good doctor Bartolo, who tends to the injured migrants and has a reasonable amount of screen time, and it gives a very moving account of the effects of his experience looking after these unfortunate individuals who are carried aboard and needing care. All of this is very beautiful, but again, for me, in the larger picture, it ties in to the idea of the Italian rescuer, and it ties into the idea of Italian humanitarianism saving the day, with an almost complete disregard for the growing militarization of the Mediterranean, the enforcement by military power of the division between the South, the global South, and the global North. And I mean, these are procedures that have terrible consequences for millions of people around the world. But to focus on a single act of hospitality or a single act of humanitarianism seems almost perverse in the larger picture. Although it's a beautiful film, I do not deny that. So, Mediterranea, on the other hand, is a very different film. Carpignano actually goes to Africa to shoot the longer trajectory of the of the migrants after leaving home as they proceed through the desert. Very few films do that. There's maybe two others I can think of that actually go to Africa. So although films about migrants in general give you a limited picture of who comes to Italy from the African continent, only those that actually bring you to Africa are very helpful about identifying who these people are and what kinds of journeys they have to endure to get to the Mediterranean and beyond. Now, one of the things I liked about Mediterranea is the inclusion of digital media, the acknowledgement of the technological expertise of these people who make these long journeys. I mean, many of them are well-educated. They speak multiple languages. They're wired. They know how to use the internet perfectly for their needs. And there are no other films, apart from this one, that really give you that kind of picture of migrant subjectivity, as informed, as resourceful, as totally modernized, completely up to date in terms of the technologies that need to be deployed to get from A to B. We don't see that in any other films. And then we have, of course, the whole conflagration at Rosarno, which is something that all Italians will remember because it was so widely televised at the time, the so-called riot of Rosarno, and the transformation of this protagonist, who was a reasonable and totally likable person, into this violent participant in the riots. And you understand, finally, the kinds of conditions that led to the rebellion on the part of the migrants in Rosarno, that this was not an irrational moment of violence. It was something clearly prompted by actual social conditions that needed to be recognized and made public.
Now, for, you know, a movie like Fuoco a Mare that was so heavily circulated, or even a movie like Mediterranea that had discrete circulation, there are so many others that instead have completely disappeared. So in your formidable revisitation of a cinematic repertoire made of films that one could occasionally define as belli e introvabili, which is the name that Chuck used to give for an award for films that disappeared because of the difficulty in accessing many of them, you have done the impossible, offering probing and nuanced textual analysis while occupying the role of storyteller. Your discussion of these films is so captivating and thorough that your reader truly feels at the movie theater. Do you think that the role of the critic is also that of archivist, or better, of preserver of stories? What is the relationship, in your view, between criticism and storytelling?
Well, this is a sort of sensitive issue for me because, as you probably know, telling the plot or telling a story about a film is so unpopular these days and is considered very passé. But at the same time, I was looking at films that I realized that most of my readers would never have seen and will never see in the future because I had to go to great lengths to find most of them. So I was faced with the choice. Either I could speak very abstractly about these films or I could try to fill in some of the narrative context that was relevant to my overall appraisal of the importance of this film in terms of my overarching concerns. So I resorted to some storytelling, but with misgivings. But you know, what inspired me was when I first started doing film studies, people like Teresa de Laurentiis were writing about independent cinema and experimental cinema, and films that were very, very hard to get hold of. And this was long before, you know, CDs, online stuff. And I was always so grateful that there was some descriptive element, because I could then understand the analysis once I was able to visualize the narrative context. So I took my lead from these early models in my own film education and allowed myself to tell the stories. Now, my storytelling of a film, however, would be, of course, be different from somebody else's. So I tried to restrain myself in making too many assumptions. But I do think that there is a place for storytelling in film criticism and in film analysis, because I don't consider myself a film critic. I consider myself a film analyst, because my overall aim is not to appraise the aesthetic value of a film, but rather to focus on other concerns that are more interesting to me.
But isn't there also an element of film historian in what you're doing?
Yes, absolutely. There is, because you create not exactly a canon, but you create by making reference to particular films, you make these films visible again in a certain way. So I'm very aware of that, and I hope that, you know, having written about films that are very difficult to find, will in the future prompt further interest in those films that are difficult to find and make them more accessible.
Well, you know, it's works like yours, Anya, that allow us to go back and actually look for these films and sometimes maybe prompt the re-release of certain films, you know, if there's enough demand, if there's enough critical demand. I mean, I'll give you an example. You have a section on Suicide Story by Roberta Torre, which was only released on VHS. Yet is a really important film for what it does. It engages with genre in a way that is extremely innovative, but it doesn't do what Tano da Morire had done a few years earlier. And so while Tano da Morire remains available, everybody has forgotten about Suicide Story. But, you know, here comes your book, and it's there, and it's there to stay, and it's actually inscribed in a genealogy that really enriches its content and its treatment of the issues you're talking about.
Yes, I agree. I think it's important to give space to these discursive space to these otherwise disappeared films, these lost
absolutely
gems. Yeah,
absolutely. So Donald Trump was elected on the promise of building a wall with Mexico. Former Italian Secretary of Interiors Matteo Salvini talked about building a wall on the northeast border with Slovenia. The discussion of borders and borderscapes plays a central role in the last few chapters of your book. Do you think your study on migration in Italian cinema speaks to a wider audience and to global concerns when discussing borderscapes? And if so, how?
Well, that's a big question. I hope that my book speaks to wider global issues. Whether or not that will have any effect is impossible to tell. But one of the things I learned a lot about in the process of writing the book was how borders work, how they're constructed, not only on the ground, but also in the imagination, the effects that discursive accounts of the border can have in making borders more entrenched or more porous, and so on. And while I was writing the last chapters, I was very aware of parallels between the Mediterranean border and the U.S. border with Mexico. Those two phenomena were happening in tandem, but there wasn't much discourse, you know, relating the one to the other. But certainly the increasing militarization and policing of the border between the north and south of the world, and particularly the criminalization of northbound movement from the south of the world, was something that struck me very forcibly in both cases. So this focus on borders is not just something that's happening in Italian cinema, it's happening elsewhere as well. There's, of course, this Ai Weiwei's book on, film or installation or video on refugees more generally in different parts of the world. It does a brilliant job of of bringing the issue of borders and border crossing into view. And there are many films from Germany, France, Sweden, and Greece, for example, that also focus on the border in our contemporary world. And films like Petzold's Transit last year, that even though it sets the narrative in an earlier time, is really about the way borders function in our presence and the way that borders racialize and divide north and south of the world. So that's something that I didn't predict when I began writing this book, is that I would end up researching borders in particular beyond the scope of the book. It's just a topic that I'm now completely immersed in.
So this brings us to questions of discipline boundaries, disciplinary boundaries, and audience. How does your book fit right now in the scholarship on Italian cinema, but also in a wider understanding of film studies? And, you know, you talk about the importance of discourses of nation, while also placing a lot of emphasis on the importance of transnational concerns and approaches in your book. Who is your audience, and also where do you go next?
Well, there are a lot of questions in that question, Giancarlo.
I know.
I'm not sure where to start.
Anywhere you feel comfortable.
Well, the last thing you said was, where am I going next? So that's what I'll answer first. I am currently starting a new project on transgender, transborder, because I'm very interested in discourses of passing, transiting, morphing, and so on. Narratives of transformation, and also the different perspectives and experiences implicated in the crossing of all international borders. But in the case of transgender subjects, this is rendered even more fraught, even more fascinating. So I don't know if this project will evolve into a book or not, but for the moment, I'm finishing my first article on this topic, which has fascinated me, and which resonates in other films made in Europe, which I may actually, if I do write a book, will include films made outside Italy as well.
Yeah.
So what else was in your
question? So what else? Let's talk about your audience. Who is your audience,
okay. And
where does your book fit in terms of discipline, in terms of disciplinary boundaries?
Okay, disciplinary boundaries, that's easy. I would say cultural studies, Italian cultural studies as the specific subfield is where I am. Initially it started out as simply as a film studies project. But it really became a cultural studies project. The research for my book brought me to all kinds of readings, and I've always been an omnivorous reader. So my sources were drawn from fields as distant as psychoanalysis and migration studies, anthropology and political analysis. And not all of these interdisciplinary explorations have left visible marks on the completed book. In fact, some have been suppressed, such as psychoanalysis. But all of these fields have enriched my approach, and I wouldn't have been able to bring them together if it hadn't been for the model of cultural studies, which allows very wide interdisciplinary explorations. So that's the field that I would say that my book connects with. And the other question, who is my reader?
Yes.
So there's a real conundrum here, because for many of us academics writing today, when academic publication is changing shape and the opportunities for publishing densely theoretical work, especially in film studies, are scarcer than in the recent past. Nowadays, academic publishing houses that still bring out books in print are wary of investing in hard copy that won't be bought by people other than librarians. So, as you know, when you submit a book proposal today to a university press, you have to argue for its market appeal.
Yeah.
And while making these arguments, I had to think about who is my book addressing. publishers prefer books that have the potential of being bought by students rather than by libraries and experts in the field, for obvious reasons. So in creating my initial book proposal, I had to figure out who the book is addressed to. I wanted it to be accessible both to students and specialists, but at the same time, since the issues that I'm addressing are quite complex, I didn't want to oversimplify my approach. So I found the balance a delicate one. And at the editing stage, I eliminated whole paragraphs, whole pages of theoretical explication, as I said, particularly psychoanalytical material. And I sometimes wonder if I went too far in trying to make the text accessible to a broad range of readers. But I hope at least that some will find some benefit in it.
I have no doubt they will. And on this note, Anya, I would like to thank you for a really great discussion of your book, which I am sure will live a long life. It's a great contribution to film studies, and it's been an honor to talk to you about this. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
So thanks a lot for listening to this installment of the Italian Studies Channel on the New Books Network. Please come back to check out our other podcasts on topics like art history, Italian cinema, medieval literature, television studies.
And even more than that, history of thought, contemporary women's writing, gender studies, codicology.
As well as politics and religion in Italy, opera, queer theory, Jewish studies, Dante, Machiavelli, you get the idea.
We are your Italian studies hosts.
Giancarlo Lombardi,
Nicoletta Marini-Maio,
and Ellen Nirenberg.
All comments and questions can be addressed to itst@gmail.com.
E grazie dell'ascolto.
Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll see you next time.